Good morning.
And that is the end of the Robo DJ playing that last song that I really didn't like so much. And you're now entering human-based radio here on WMFO 91.5 FM. That's Medford, Tufts Freeform, Medford, Massachusetts, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio here at 91.5 FM and WMFO.org on computer. And you're listening to WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford. Just wanted to say that again because that is what we're supposed to do. My name is Jeff. I'll be hosting you for the next 2 hours with Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we're here every other Sunday with not just alternative information and news and so on, like you might hear on other progressive radio shows or left-wing radio shows or the odd socialist radio show, which doesn't really exist very much except here and a few other places. But we're also here to try to help organize. We're trying to help organize working people and young people, which is the vast majority of the population. We have a very broad definition of working class. It's not your cliched sort of, monochrome, blue-collar cliche about what's working class. So that's certainly people that do building trades work and so on are certainly working class, but also are people like teachers and people like even, let's say, a lawyer starting out that doesn't have, that's working for a big firm, or let's say a doctor that's in residency, or down the other part of the scale, someone that can't find work. They're trying to sell their labor to the system, as workers must do under capitalism, and can't get anyone to buy it because of various factors. So maybe there's a labor surplus in the area they're looking, the geographical region they're looking, the type of jobs that they can do. Maybe they're old and there's a lot of age discrimination and the capitalists won't hire them anymore. Maybe they are too young. I tried to get a job when I was 16 and got turned away because I had tried to work. I had to try to work and couldn't find anything that year, which was tough. So there's a lot of various injustices built into capitalism that make it hard for workers just go out and get one of those jobs, you know, and if they get one, to get one that you can survive on, that you can build a future on. As you know, if you're living in this country, if you're at all awake to the suffering of other people or awake to your own family and people around you, our work lives are getting more and more precarious, meaning precarious, big word, but precarious basically means the future is not certain. For precarious means something could go wrong and you could lose that job at any minute. And that's what we're living now as unions get weaker, although there's some news about that that we've discussed, put forward on this show, of fight back by unions here and there, like the West Virginia Teachers Union as the best example. Teachers unions fighting back and winning big wage increases and so on. So it's a mixed picture. Working people are always struggling in one way or another here in the United States. And I reference the show by United States because we do have, because of the wonders of the internet, we do go out internationally. The on-air signal here, the airwave signal that goes out into the atmosphere is rather limited. The show emanates from Tufts University. We also call ourselves Tufts Educational Radio here sometimes. And it's an okay signal for a college station. Goes out to Medford, parts of Medford, Somerville, hits parts of Boston, parts of the western, northern, I would say northern suburbs a little bit here. But it's variable, you know, and it doesn't hit all the same, it doesn't have the same range all the time, depending on things to do with radio technology I don't quite understand. But we do have also the internet, WMFO.org, where you can tune into WMFO shows like this one, Socialist Alternative Radio, and listen to them live streaming over the internet, or go to the archive function, click on the show you want, like Socialist Alternative Radio, for example, and listen to the last week or two archive. Now, because we're on every other week, I think we basically only have a one show archive. They have a rule here, last I checked, of only archiving two shows and then starting over again. I wish we could say we had all our shows archived. There was a Facebook/website/blog, maybe, called Fenian Rising, F-E-N-I-A-N Rising. And on their own, they decided to start, you know, downloading our shows and archiving them. And that was great. I don't know if they had the patience to continue that, but we appreciate whatever they the years they did. That was great. We've been on about 10 years or so. And we are, like I started to say, we're here to not just give you alternative information, but here to help organize you into the socialist movement, hopefully. And a lot of the information that I put forward is from Social Alternative, which is an actual organization. So, you know, it's not just a sort of abstract, just it's more than a website. It's people actually out there organizing. You may have heard of Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A. S-A-W-A-N-T, that's a socialist out in Seattle, Washington, that has been elected not once but twice, elected and reelected to city council as an open socialist, as a member of Socialist Alternative, and putting for and leading a lot of good struggles there with the help of Socialist Alternative and others to, for example, win the first $15 minimum wage law in the country, which happened a couple years ago. And two, or was it 3 years ago now? And also to recently get a tax on Amazon, the biggest, second biggest corp, biggest or second biggest corporation in the world now, and with the richest or second richest person in the world, Bezos, Jeff Bezos. I get the I have the first and second thing going back and forth in my head. But anyway, that law was quickly repealed by the quote-unquote progressive Democrats in Seattle that all but one caved very quickly on the city council due to pressure from Amazon, and they repealed a law they had just put in a few weeks earlier that they had all voted for. But that took a lot to get them to get the pressure up to force them to vote on that. It took a mass movement in Seattle, or a big movement in Seattle, let's say, led by Socialist Alternative and others, and it was tied to housing, so there were housing groups involved, pro-housing, you know, anti-homeless groups involved. And that was a great victory in the sense of the fact that it won. It showed that you could win progressive taxation still in this day and age in the United States, where the Democrats and Republicans both are like, where's the money going to come from? There's no money for that, you know? Where there's tons of money. The money is always there. When they say the money's not there, the money's there. They just don't want to do the fight. They don't want to ruin their campaign contributions. They don't want to ruin their portfolios. You know, they're with the profile of the U.S. Congress right now and a lot of politicians, we're talking about millionaires that are in power directly, not just using corporate tools as they have historically through the Republican and Democratic parties, but they are actually... You have very rich people now directly, and you always have had some, but now it's getting worse, directly sitting in these capitalist parties in the city councils, state legislatures, and Congress, U.S. Congress here in the United States. So it's a question of now, if you talk about progressive taxation, they're going to feel that in their own pockets, and they don't like it. So there's never any money for anything, and here we are with a so-called economic boom going on, with relatively low unemployment supposedly, and yet there's no money for all sorts of things that people need. We're going to get into that. We're going to talk a lot about the economy today and what it means for working people, because you know, that is I think a burning question right now that is not getting, it's getting some attention in the corporate media. I was a little surprised that, you know, last time there was an economic boom, last few times, you know, the old cliches sort of were dragged out by some capitalist economists and you know, corporate media reporters, if you want to call them that, or transmission belts for capitalist propaganda. They would say basically, wow, this things are going so well with the economy, this might be the end of the business cycle. Business cycle is a code word for actually something that Karl Marx, one of the founders of scientific socialism and others, identified as the, you know, the continued or episodic but constant you know, if you look at it from a worldview, overproduction and overcapacity in capitalist production, meaning that there's no plan. It's the anarchy of profit mongering. And so you have capitalists competing with each other. You have nation states being used to compete economically, to extend, to use military force or tariffs, as we're seeing now, and other economic measures to extend market share, to be able to exploit cheap labor, to be able to exploit cheap natural resources from weaker countries. And all that equals a sort of, you know, the anarchy of capitalist production based on continual short-term maximization of profit as the goal. And that could include, you know, competing with, buying out. It does include competing with and buying out rival capitalist companies, corporations, regardless of how big. You have monopolies vying with monopolies. That doesn't solve anything. It just brings the competition to a deadlier, higher, more wasteful, dangerous level under the system. So routinely, the capitalists don't guess or don't plan or don't, you know, they don't plan on a macro scale. They plan individually to some extent. But on a macro scale, meaning a world scale or a nationwide scale, or even a state, or you pick your region, there's invariably going to be a lot of waste under capitalism, a lot of things made that can't get sold because there aren't enough people making enough money to buy them. And this happens so often that at times the aggregate effect, quantity turning into quality, so to speak, to use a phrase from Marxist dialectics, you have a full-blown economic crisis where so many goods and services are going unbought that the companies start laying off, which exacerbates the problem. If you're laid off, you can buy even less, and so on. And it just starts to spiral down into a recession, like the Great Recession of 2007, 2008, or the Depression in the 1930s, or, you know, in other countries, deep, sharp depressions. In some countries, the collapse of the system, at least in the sense of, the nation state gets so, based on the economic problems, gets so fragmented in a place like the, you know, South Sudan for a time at least, or in Libya and other places, and it's based on wars and so on, which are a term based on economics, that you can have the system reduced to some sort of which is warlords, you know, stealing and bartering and stuff like that. It doesn't really look so much like capitalism anymore. Capitalism will reassert itself on a primitive level in any place. It's a sort of, it's the dominant system in the world, and it's it abhors a vacuum in a sense. As Marx and others wrote, you know, capitalism very quickly spread across the world and continues that that churning and rechurning up of old markets to create more profits. So things that capitalism will strive to commodify everything, turn everything into something you can buy and sell, including human labor, of course, right from its start. And so you have a situation where things that one moment were, say, part of a social welfare net in a country are then thrown into the open market. Things that are part of, like, say, public transportation, privatized, thrown into the open capitalist market, and people all of a sudden have to try to pay for them or do without. And mostly it's do without, really, a lot of the times. And therefore, those things that were considered rights for one generation are quickly, in the next generation, something you have to buy. Let's say pensions in the United States, for example. People are basically being conditioned to put money into their own retirement accounts rather than have retirement pension funds, defined benefit pension funds, they call them, where the company, as a benefit to get you to work there and to make you happy, or happier. No one's ever happy truly at work, in my opinion. But they are given those pensions that were part of a package of benefits that unions would negotiate, or non-union companies trying to mimic union companies would negotiate, would put forward. Those pensions, of course, have largely disappeared, not entirely, but to a great extent, and replaced with pension with financial plans that are tied to the stock market, in a way to get people to think like they're little capitalists or something, when really they're the amount of money that they have tied in the stock market is minuscule, and that usually entails encouragement, at least if not forced coercion, to put money into those retirement accounts, whereas a defined benefit pension before was just, you know, the company would be putting in money based on agreements with unions or their own system as a benefit for working there. There's so many examples like that. In healthcare, the United States never had, single payer, socialized medicine, all the different terms for basically whether you keep some sort of insurance thing involved or not. It's one insurance company. You would still have healthcare as a, you know, guaranteed to the population at an extremely low cost or for free. And most industrialized countries, big capitalist countries have some version of this now, although it's always under attack. It's always chipped away at by the bourgeois, meaning the ruling capitalist class, trying to privatize, trying to get more profit off of healthcare, and as seen as a market they're not totally exploiting yet. And in the United States, we never had, socialized medicine, national healthcare system, or even single payer. But I remember, and I just got into this on Facebook with someone, I remember that we had, when I was a kid, we had a heavily regulated system, and most people were on were affiliated to one insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield. That might have been a regional thing, it might have been a national thing, I have to double check that, but certainly in the region I lived in, New York State, most people had that. It was heavily regulated, and therefore healthcare costs were often paid by companies because of union negotiations and so on, and even non-union companies, again, trying to keep up with what the standard the unions would set across millions of workers' benefit packages. So I remember going into, for example, this is what triggered the Facebook encounter, was someone complaining, correctly so, that they couldn't see a doctor except during strict working hours. It was very hard for them to find a doctor they could see after five, between at any time other than 9 to 5, and that's when they work, right? And this is typical of all sorts of things in the United States, where people are forced into taking time off to get services of all sorts that should be available at night and on weekends, but they're not. They're only available 9 to 5, and that's become more and more the case with healthcare. And so, unless you pay an exorbitant fee, I'm not saying just exorbitant, I'm saying like truly life-altering, horrible cost of going to an emergency room, and we'll get into that later if we have time. What one couple experienced here in the United States when they actually used an ambulance. That's becoming something you can't do now in the United States, is actually have an ambulance ride without getting charged tens of thousands of dollars unless you're sure your insurance covers it. You better be really, really sure, because a lot of times insurance doesn't cover what people think it covers. But anyway, the point is that these things that used to be heavily regulated and costs kept down, and partially due to government regulations, partially due to the strength of unions, it's now a free-for-all. It's every man for himself and God against all, so to speak, to quote a phrase. It's just the anarchy of capitalism, basically, and it's just wreaking havoc here. But there's no organized expression to fight it. We don't have in the United States a political party for working people in general. And we don't have even what they had in Europe, or still have in a lot of countries, old social democratic parties that started out, revolutionary, and over time got co-opted, like, say, the British Labour Party. Now, the British Labour Party still has a left wing that's trying to turn it back into a party independent of big business, after years of right wing, like people like Tony Blair, trying to turn it into the Democratic Party, which is a party controlled by corporations here in the United States. So there's a lot of social democratic parties in Europe, or the Socialist Party in France, for example, that have become pro-capitalist over time, even though they started out with socialist and revolutionary roots. But the fact that those parties did have at one time and for a while those goals and those methods, and they were completely independent of big business or corporate money for time again, that is still something historically significant. And there have been many parties that have spun off of those parties or new left formations from other left groups and so on in Europe that create new parties that are independent of the corporations and big business. So in many European countries and many other countries around the world, if you're a working person, if you're a young person that gets concerned about social justice, you can actually vote for a political party that is not controlled by big business and the corporations. It might be a political party that makes mistakes, might be a political party that's evolving into betraying itself and evolving into a pro-capitalist party. But at least it has that that moment, that initial foundation, and perhaps sticking to it much longer, keeps staying, you know, to the left, true left, and really socialist and really independent of the corporate money. And that gives you some power, and they can have some seats in parliament and so on, and it creates a much different class consciousness among working people. And it creates a much different, you know, that they understand their working class. They understand that more people understand their working class, and that they have interests completely opposite of capitalism and big business. More people, not everyone, of course, and it gets complicated with other issues intersecting and that that consciousness. But at least you have more to work with there, more of a chance of reaching working people with some sort of social justice. Again, that doesn't last forever. I mean, if a workers' party takes power, doesn't deliver, the betrayal felt is tremendous. You know, the Mexican people in Mexico, there's about to be an election by a candidate that should have won a previous election, who's nominally left wing, López Obrador, in the Moreno movement, and they, I mean, it might be Morena, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, and they are, this is a great hope for a lot of Mexican people. You know, we hope that he does win. But unfortunately, it's probably going to take, I mean, unfortunately, a couple things. He's been kind of moving his program, and that party's been moving its ideas, what it puts forward to the people, in a more conservative direction. Not entirely, of course. They still talk about eliminating poverty and so on, which is very good. But they it's a little more complicated. They've kind of tacked to the right a little bit. And there's a very danger, even if they kept to their the way they started, to their left-wing methods and ideals, even if they had kept to that, they face what I'll just use shorthand for, I'll call the Chavez moment, you know, where you take on the system on a national basis and you've got two choices, basically. You've taken on big business the way Chavez did, and you decide, okay, I'm going to do everything I can with this position in government and my party's position in government to mobilize as many people as I can, politically, even militarily if necessary, to take over the commanding heights of the economy. The biggest corporations are going to go under public ownership, and then we're going to plan democratically what they produce and how it's going to be distributed for people's needs, not for private profit mongering, not for private profit. And that's a key, that now the minute you move significantly in that direction, as Chavez didn't really nationalize a lot of the economy, but some key companies. The minute you start to move that way, of course, you run into the entire weight of, you know, the U.S. government, its propaganda, its money. Talk about interfering in elections. Ha ha. The U.S. is always interfering in elections. And moving and to crush, for example, Chavez and now The Maduro in Venezuela, though Maduro's record isn't, I don't think, the same as Chavez's in terms of starting to make gains against the capitalist hegemony, as they say, over the economy, capitalist dictatorship over the economy, let's say. So you're faced with a party, a leader. They're faced with that's really socialist. Is faced with the problem of the nationally based capitalists refusing to invest, creating economic chaos. In essence, a strike of capital, if you want to look at it that way. And how are you going to fight that? The only way to really fight that is to take over into public ownership those big corporations. I mean, they're being run by workers anyway. I mean, it's social production at a mass scale. It's just the owners that don't do any work, really, that own it. And that's just a legal fiction that you can overturn quickly and take it over into public ownership and then democratically run the company, make a plan, democratic plan nationally. But then you run into a second problem, again, that outside pressure from like the United States and other big capitalist or what is known as imperialist countries, meaning big capitalist countries that use their economic weight to enforce militarily and economically their will on the weaker countries. So what do you do then? You have to spread this internationally and spread the movement internationally, the socialist movement internationally. And that's where internationalism comes from. It's such a big part of the socialist movement, and yet many socialist organizations and parties, they are stuck relearning the basic lessons that were learned way back in the 19th century, even, of the need for internationalism. They kind of forgot about it, don't pay attention to it, don't think it's possible, whatever, and they get stuck in that quandary, that conundrum, where they can't break the power of imperialism weighing down on them from the outside, isolating them the way Venezuela is being isolated, the way Cuba has been isolated, for example. And yet they haven't set up that international network of groups and parties needed to be able to simultaneously fight for socialism in many different countries around the world. So that's a long-winded way of saying in Mexico, López Obrador will probably be elected today. 20% lead in the polls most recently, and if not elected, there'll be charges, correctly so, charges of big fraud and probably huge protests against a third election being stolen. But if López Obrador wins, these problems that I just mentioned will arise very quickly, and Mexico's already under tremendous pressure from the United States, and the weight of the U.S. economy and the weight of U.S. political policies. And I'm not just thinking of immigration, although that's huge. It's just things like NAFTA and so on, which, you know, has been rewritten in the liberal in the liberal worldview as a positive thing. And NAFTA was, of course, a horrific trade deal that threw many Mexican farmers and peasants out of work, because it opened up Mexico to huge imports of huge agribusiness produced food from the United States, and also got rid of all sorts of union and social benefit rights, let's say, to put it simply, that existed in Mexico and in Canada and in the United States, and subsumed them, made them inferior to the NAFTA laws, the laws promulgated, the laws surrounding and part of NAFTA, so that there's a lot of union busting, a lot of cheap labor set up in the Maquiladora region and other places in Mexico, and you know, labor unions were really, really hurt by it. Part of what's weakened unions over the last decades, so, you know, in Mexico, the election of a nominal left winger is something that in context of the current election is to be supported, but with eyes wide open, there's going to be real problems. And the problems cannot be solved just on a national basis. They have to be fought there too, but they also have to be fought internationally. So if there was a large workers' party or socialist party or whatever in the United States, Labor Party or something, it could, in solidarity with the Mexican people voting for a left-wing party now, and they could help put political pressure on the United States, or if this party was in power, could help directly with, helping develop the Mexican economy on a solidaristic basis, not a exploitative basis. And that's not doesn't exist here. You know, without a workers' party in this country, we have a lot of problems that are made worse than if we had a workers' party, a socialist party, or a labor party of some sort. The name isn't really that important. You see these names of left-wing parties have different names in different countries. Left bloc in Portugal, Podemos in Spain, meaning we can do it. The Syriza party in Greece, although that's sold out, that started out as a left-wing, kind of left-wing formation that was going against the whole neoliberal, whole capitalist Eurozone attacks on different countries. By the way, Italy, a fun fact is we're going around here a little bit on the question of a workers' party. Italy has more debt than Greece even had, and that's becoming known. And you're going to see the World Bank and the IMF most likely go in for the kill like they did in Greece and demand even more austerity. And Italy's already suffered through years of austerity and currently has a sort of populist, in many ways, right-wing government in power. In some ways, the populism swings the other way in Italy right now. You know, watch for that. They just had elections recently in Italy. But anyway, back to Mexico. Back to the United States. Without a workers' party, there's so many... That's one reason Trump could come in so quickly and so quickly undo so many laws that seem to be there for a while. These laws seem to be strong, but they weren't. They weren't strong. They were weak laws. They were usually compromises brought in by the Democratic Party, kicking and screaming under the weight of some sort of movement that forced through legislation that had holes in it, basically, that was weak, that people could find fault with, even if they support the general point. And also, who's the main point I was going to make, and but this is a more subtle point in terms of how it affects consciousness. When you have a law with so many holes in it that big business can easily exploit the weaknesses, that in itself is a problem. So, for example, here in Massachusetts, they just passed a law that's totally dominated by the Democrats, but there's a Republican governor. So in negotiations with the legislature, the governor ends up signing a law. There's many facets to it. One is a $15 minimum wage, so that sounds good, and we support that. But it's if you look at the fine print, it's being brought in slowly, very slowly, slower than it was supposed to be brought in the way the law was originally introduced as a referendum. Now it's not going to be a referendum. It's just there's a law. There could have been a referendum. There still could be one and probably should be in the next time that can get organized, because there's so many holes in what I'm about to describe. Basically, that the $15 hour minimum wage law comes in so slowly. And then also, you know, year by year, they're talking about like 2023 or something like that. And then on top of that, it doesn't cover tipped workers. They get a bump in pay, but it's not anywhere near 15. And I don't believe it covers underage workers. I have to double check on that. Meaning workers under 18. But let's hold off on that. I'm not sure on that one. But what it also does, it ties the 15 thing into some regressive things, an increased payroll tax to pay in turn, a payroll tax on workers I'm talking about, and some on the, I guess a little bit on the corporations too, to create a fund for a certain amount of family paid leave, which is also a good thing that we support. But for workers to get taxed more to support it is going to leave it vulnerable to many workers saying they don't like it when they find out they're being taxed more for it. There's also the back to the 15. It was originally supposed to be indexed to inflation. So every year when it came up again, it would go up according to inflation plus getting to 15, and then after 15, go up indexed to inflation. That was stricken. That was torn away from it. And, you know, the rush to compromise that the Democratic Party is always doing. Basically what I'm getting at is the Democratic Party and the Republicans are so adept when they feel they need to put something forward. They're so adept at leaving it so full of holes and so weak that it is being set up basically for some sort of attack in the future. you know, because they don't have any confidence in what they're doing. You know, it's with trepidation and under a lot of pressure from movements developing around the country for 15 that the Democrats even looked at it. And when we were putting it forward in Social Alternative and others were putting it forward years ago, we were running into severe opposition from Democrats. Just too much, you know, severe opposition from Republicans. But anyway, the point is with we're in the United States right now in a sort of supposed booming economy, and attacks on unions are happening. As I'm going to describe when we get into the economy, inflation for working people is huge, meaning there are things that aren't measured by the larger inflation numbers, but even those are going up. But the things that aren't measured by the larger inflation numbers that are going up drastically that workers have to pay for, and it's extremely difficult. So you have people working two jobs, the so-called gig economy and all that. But on top of it, you have more precarious jobs than you used to have with fewer benefits. For example, less jobs with pensions. You know, health care costs skyrocketing, even if you have insurance. And so who, when these problems arise, or let's look at immigration problems as well, with in terms of immigrants being terribly exploited by the big corporations, being terrorized by ICE, being used as a divide and conquer tool against other workers, by the big capitalists, by propaganda from the corporate media and so on. So who's going to lead the fight against all these problems? And by the way, that last problem is completely insoluble under capitalism, although we, of course, stand for immigrant rights, including a full amnesty for immigrants. But it's an insoluble problem under capitalism, because capitalism forces migration, the harsh horrors of the capitalist economy and what it engenders, what it gives birth to, incredible violence, you know, even here in the richest capitalist country in the world. Incredible levels of personal and societal violence. It's just, if you step back from it for a second and really think about it, it's a really sick society. And the violence and the opioid crisis and other social indicators show that, but they're never put in a context like that. They're never tied to capitalism. They're just all these problems that exist. So very pragmatically, we must look at them, and we must find pragmatic solutions that directly address the actual act of, like, injection or something, you know, like the actual drug or drugs that people are abusing and so on, rather than thinking, you know, if everyone had decent housing, decent work, you know, enough to live on, maybe they wouldn't feel despair about their future and about their lives, you know, and that's a capitalist problem, you know, that lack of decent housing, decent jobs, etc. Or, you know, with other problems, you know, not tracing them to capitalism, but just treating them as all separate problems. So today we're going to address the opioid crisis, and then tomorrow we'll address the problem of the increased cost of health care and the lack of insurance and insurance that doesn't cover this and that. And, well, that's related to the opioid crisis, even on your pragmatic scale, even in your, way of looking at things. It's just all fact, or supposed fact, and never generality, how these facts fit together and how they are changing and so on, which is what Marxism looks at through dialectical materialism. So what at the point I'm keep getting to and then backing off from to describe some process or to talk about something is that right now, where there are glaring problems, whether it's the immigration crisis, whether it's the healthcare crisis in the United States, whether it's the childcare crisis in the United States, which a lot of people don't talk about, whether it's the precarious jobs and the low wages and so on and so forth, you don't see the Democratic Party. You don't even see the progressive so-called Democrats. And I have real problems with that designation, because one minute a progressive, next minute voting doing Amazon's bidding and voting to take a tiny tax away from Amazon, being put on Amazon. So one minute progressive Democrat, next minute charter school proponent, you know, one minute progressive Democrat, next minute voting for a huge billions of dollars increase in the war spending from the United States. I don't buy progressive Democrat for a second, but let's just use that term for a point of reference as a thought experiment here. This is really the reality. You have Democrats, self-styled progressive, self-styled quote-unquote socialist, which is absolutely impossible. You can't be a Democrat in the Democratic Party, a capitalist party, and be a socialist. Sorry, you lose your credentials at the door when that happens. Maybe you'll get them back someday, but in my book, it should be very, very difficult to spend time shilling for the capitalists and the capitalist political party and then claim years later, now I'm a socialist. Yep, okay. And I'm not putting that on the voters. I'm not putting on the people that vote Democrat or Republican. That's a transitory thing. Most people don't even vote. Well, a slim majority in the last presidential election voted of registered voters. But anyway, most people overall don't vote in the United States. That's not necessarily a good thing at all. We want people to vote. But I understand if there's nothing to vote for, you're not going to rush out and it's not going to be your first thing you think of. Especially with all the problems with voting in this country, having it on work days and all the laws they put in to make it difficult to vote. What I'm getting at is basically the Democratic Party, including the so-called progressives, including Bernie Sanders, who declares himself independent but is really a Democrat, they some of them, like Sanders, talk the talk about mass movements being necessary to make change, but they don't walk the walk in terms of organizing them because the mass movements around issues or around the system itself, and that's what they really fear, could get out of control. They could start to threaten the system, and they just don't want that unwieldy thing that could get out of their control. For example, Sanders, turns everything over to Clinton, and then goes back with a high degree of popularity and starts a group called Our Revolution. But Our Revolution is not a group it's not a membership based organization that is out on its own. It's not like, you know, campaigning, you know, running candidates. They endorse candidates, but they don't. It's not an organization that's becoming a new political party, which is really what's necessary, or a part of a new political party. It is endorsing Democratic Party candidates selectively, and sometimes not so selectively. Sometimes just blanket endorsements of people running against each other. And letting the chips fall where they may. You can join on paper, but you're not going to be part of a vibrant campaigning organization with, democratic decision making and so on and so forth. It's not like a union. It's not like a political party. It's like an NGO, more or less. Regardless of the existence of Our Revolution, you don't see Sanders out with that or with any other vehicle. Or by himself, even organizing mass movements. He'll make a speech, usually ill-timed, about intent in terms of, like, it's not the thing uppermost on people's minds, which is okay if it's an educational purpose or whatever. But it's not tapping into, like, organizationally building anything. It's not even trying to initiate organization to build anything. It is just propagandizing, which has its place, but it's not building the organizational muscle, because again, the Democrats don't want to do that, even individual Democrats, because it can get quickly out of their control, threaten their system, and lead to a third party, frankly, lead to an organization that will be competing with them soon after its formation, if one gets off the ground in this country, which is likely. And so then you have the labor leaders. They're in a very weakened state. Most of them still see themselves as running some sort of little business instead of running a union or helping to organize a union. And so you still have a lot of, business unionism or insurance company unionism instead of, that means that what I mean by that is basically organizing a union as a service that you only engage with when you're in trouble or something, you know, rather than a union as a social movement. So you have a lot of labor leaders that don't have a clue about organizing their own members. They don't have a socialist vision, which is how unions started and which has kept a lot of unions going. Left-wingers with a vision of the union as being part of a bigger movement to change society. And if you don't have that vision, if you don't have the tactics or even the will to organize your own members into a force, then to help not only themselves but others as well outside of the union or in the larger union or larger labor movement, then you're already on the defensive. You're already leaving yourself open as a victim of capitalism. And as we've talked about on the show before, there was a time when unions were stronger, and a lot of people, including myself, couldn't foresee a time where labor leaders would just give up. I mean, we thought that, well, okay, so their livelihood depends on union dues, and as the unions get attacked more and more, this is going back, I'm talking about like the 80s now, therefore they're going to attack back to save their own skins, to save their own jobs and so on, at least. Not the healthiest situation, but it, in the struggle and struggling along with them, maybe there will be some exchange of, let's say, views that will the labor leaders will start to understand more how important unions are to society as a whole, to the working class as a whole, and they're not just little clubs or little, as they used to say back in the 30s, little job trusts. They are social organizations, campaigning organizations. They are organizations that can form the foundation of a workers' party or a labor party and so on. So are the labor leaders, even with the attacks of the Janus decision, which we'll get into in a minute, a court decision that hurts unions and so on, even with these attacks, is the labor movement as a whole changing, going back to its roots, its socialist roots, and fighting big business? And with a few brilliant exceptions, again, like the West Virginia teachers, the Arizona teachers, and others, and other smaller struggles, not just teachers. UPS workers, for example, just passed a strike vote, which is really, really a good sign, although they probably won't go on strike. It's unclear. Are the unions leading? And they could, even in their weakened state of, 6-7% private sector, 30% or whatever public sector, they could still lead, especially in certain areas, huge movements against Trump out on the streets. I'm not talking about like lobbying. I'm talking about out on the streets, creating organizations they could bring on new people into, and especially culminating those kind of efforts would be starting a new political party for working people. Instead of doing anything like that, not even just even getting on the streets very much, there were some anti-Janus protests, obviously, but that was too little, too late. Instead of occupying, et cetera, the union leaders put all their faith in the Democratic Party. And all the Democratic Party leaders put all their faith and propaganda into just getting people to turn, like the big protest movements, into make sure you vote in November movements. Make sure you vote. And the implication is Democrat, or explicitly it's said vote Democrat. Now, this strategy has existed for decades, maybe even a century, and has just not helped the labor movement. And where the strategy was overwhelmed by more direct action and by more left-wing political parties and organizations, like during the 30s and 40s, huge gains were made. But when it reverts back to waiting for Godot, in the sense of waiting for the Democratic Party to solve everything, it things get weaker and weaker. I don't remember, and I've been around a while now, I don't remember when the Democrats come back into power, I don't remember them reversing much of the Republican damage that's done before that, or vice versa. Of course, Republicans don't come in and undo the damage of the Clinton years, for example, or the Obama years. They take it and run with it. Obama was a massive deporter. Obama administration was a massive deporter of immigrants. Trump comes in. For a while, he's behind the Obama record. I don't know if he still is or not, his administration. But he, of course, makes it nastier in various ways with racist rhetoric and anti-immigrant rhetoric and so on. And weaponizing ICE more, making it rougher, and then of course the separation of families and all that other stuff that's so horrible being done to immigrants now. The perception is things are worse under Trump. Totally understand that. In some ways they are, but in some ways it's a continuation of a policy set by the Democrats in the previous, when they were in power. I'm not just talking about bipartisan quote-unquote cooperation for bad policies that hurt workers and youth, and including immigrant workers. By the way, all immigrants, or most immigrants, are working people. So there are brothers and sisters and comrades, as from the, as far as the socialist movement goes, as far as socialist alternative goes, they are not illegals. Nobody's illegal. That's crap. But anyway, the you have the Democrats not out for self-interest and for controlling, wanting to control movements and just, you know, dump them into them getting reelected. They're not, you know, the Democratic Party graveyard of social movements, as it's called by activists, some activists, is very, very true. And you can see that operating within a given moment. It doesn't even have to take years or something for that to happen. It can be like 1 minute you've got this massive, excellent women's marches happening in this country. The next minute you find out that some of the leaders of that were tied to the Democratic Party, that a lot of the speeches at the march were about just getting out to vote in for the Democrats or getting out to vote in November, implying Democrats. And then... and go run as a Democrat, and all that stuff becomes the focus then, not getting another huge demonstration out in the streets, not building independent politics for working class women as well, who are the majority of the working class. Well, actually, because of various reasons, I'm not sure they're a majority numerically of the working class in the United States, but they are the majority of the working class internationally, and probably in the United States as well, especially if you have a broad definition of working class. So, basically, so who's left to organize mass movements against Trump, against the damage that Trump is doing, against problems that existed prior to Trump and Trump is using? Like, for example, when Obama was running for office, the Democrats do this a lot. They promised labor, they like to promise labor something big, you know. With Clinton, it was health care, you know, single payer. They never even really tried that. They claim they did, but they didn't. This is the Clinton administration. Then with, of course, there was never any single payer. And then with Obama coming up for election, it was a more modest thing. It was but important. It was the Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA, which would have made it much easier for unions to organize, based on just signing up a certain majority to the union would give the union legal representation rights without going to an election, you know, without going through the period of terror and so on that the bosses can inflict on people to turn them away from a union organizing drive. And EFCA would make, after a year with no contract, mandatory arbitration for a contract. So, because right now you either go through the terror the bosses inflict on you, the big bosses, through a union campaign or trying to bring a union in. If you miraculously get a union in, and it's possible, I shouldn't have said miraculous, but it's very, very difficult, then what often happens is that there's no first contract gained. And that first contract is where, of course, you know, spell out what the pay rates are going to be, the benefits are going to be, etc. If you never get that first contract signed, the union is allowed under current labor law to just, the company is allowed under current labor law to just sort of, you know, drag things out forever until everyone gets sick of it and walks away. Where in contradistinction to EFCA, if it had been introduced and passed, it would have made it mandatory for the unions to do arbitration, for the union and management to do arbitration to a first contract, not just letting it drift into nothing. So a lot of successful union drives don't end up getting a first contract because they have to put a tremendous pressure on the companies, which they can do if they use the right tactics and so on, but oftentimes they're incapable or don't understand what they need to do, don't have the vision, the less the labor movement doesn't help enough, whatever. There's a lot of reasons. So anyway, so you have the unions not out there struggling. They're trying to get along because many of them as little business unionists, others that have a more social union vision, they're still tied to the Democrats. So they're fighting with one hand and one foot and probably half a brain tied behind their backs, so to speak. And you, of course, don't have the Democratic Party, even the Democratic Party, so-called progressives, organizing mass movements against Trump and so on. So Trump has basically solidified his position, you know. 42% in the polls, which I find really, really hard to believe, but there it is. And but I do, at the end of the day, believe it, because politics abhors a vacuum. So if the if you're not out protesting and organizing mass movements, and especially organizing a political party for working people on a mass scale, then Trump is going to get his way. The Democrats themselves are not going to be able to and don't want to stand up to everything Trump's putting out there. And the whole wait until 2017, I'm sorry, did I say 2017? Waiting until the elections in November in 2018 is a passive recipe that unfortunately a lot of people are doing. And I've gone through these times before. Reagan, just as bad, if not worse than Trump, believe it or not. And that's I hate that relativistic, you know, worse than Trump thing. They're both really horrible, obviously. Horrible enough. But that doesn't mean that there will be any, as I said at the beginning of this, rollback of their policies when the Democrats come to power. Just the opposite. They usually keep going with that. And look at Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA. This would have made it much easier to organize unions. They could have, you know, even if Janus went through, they would have in the last, in the 1.5 or 2, about 8 years of the Obama regime, if they had gotten EFCA passed, they could have made great gains. The unions could have made great gains in organizing people. Now, there's other variables. Obama might have done something to hurt unions, whatever. But what happened was the Obama administration didn't even try to introduce EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act, into Congress. And like so many other promises before, the labor movement, the AFL-CIO, just basically said, oh, and then still supported Democrats and are still supporting Democrats. So who is left to organize a mass movement? Well, maybe you look at some civil liberties groups or NGOs of various sorts and so on. They're too small, and most of them are tied to the Democratic Party. So they're focused on these elections solving everything, as if they woke up just yesterday and didn't see the pattern over the past of elections not solving anything, as long as the duopoly, as they call it, the two political parties of big business are the only ones vying for power in any real sense, the elections don't solve anything. I'm not saying boycott elections. I'm saying, you know, look for a left-wing candidate, an independent or a left-wing green or somebody that you could vote for. Not all greens are left-wing. Some are. And get in the habit of voting, but understanding you're voting to keep those voting muscles, you know, in order, but also to lay the foundations for a workers' party of some sort that would make a lot of problems for capitalism, even if it didn't take power right away. Look at the New Democratic Party in Canada when it started in 1964. It was a long time before it got any power, even on a regional level, and then it ended up getting regional power. There's a need for probably a new party in Canada, or severely reform the NDP, which is probably impossible at this point. But what happened in Canada was that the New Democratic Party was formed out of its main demand of single-payer health care, or, you know, nationalized medicine for everyone, nationalized health care. And it's a very good system up in Canada. And so if you have a workers' party in this country, you'd be getting benefits that would be helping people directly, and then have a vehicle, a place to go to meet other people, to add all your voices together, all our voices together for mass protest. You know, whenever the government front, whether Republican or Democrat, tries to move. So even under capitalism, some gains can be made. There can be a holding action. There can be organizing a new party. And, you know, some very positive things would come about that, as they have in other countries. People look at some of the benefits in other countries and say, wow, you know, especially from the United States, I never knew that. So we're going to get into that a little more. But it is now the top of the hour, 11:59 a.m., time to identify ourselves as WMFO Medford, or WMFO in Medford. Another way of identifying ourselves is, this is Jeff for Social Alternative Radio, and you are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio, also known as Tufts Commercial Free Community Based Radio. This is Socialist Alternative Radio, a little slice of that community base. Check out our Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio. Go to socialistalternative.org for the National Organization of Socialist Alternative. And also go to socialistworld.net, Committee for Works.